Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, let me grab the headphones. I'll get dialed into the studio. Get these dogs to shut up. Oh, goodness. I better close the window or the neighbors are going to get mad. Hope the guests call in tonight. I wonder if anybody's going to call in. Well, let's do this thing.
It's Rated G Radio, and this is your host, Garrett Miller.
Welcome to Rated G Radio, everybody. It is Wednesday, September 10th, and we're going to have a great show tonight. We've got celebrated author, musician, soccer star, college senior, businessman, philanthropist, and so much more, Mr. R.J. Tolson. He'll be joining the show in just a couple of minutes. But before we get to Mr. Tolson and find out all about the exciting world in which he's creating on a daily basis, I've got a question for you. I have been in the process of unsocial mediaing, if that's even a word myself, over the last week, after talking to some people who are saying, okay, it's time to start formulating, you know, the bigger plan on what you're going to be doing. They said, you know, maybe not having such a wide social footprint is, you know, something you might want to just take a look at. So I thought, you know, what a better place to start than Facebook and Twitter, because that's usually where a lot of people are doing a lot of their social commentaries on things in life. And, I don't have anything on it that I wouldn't let my mother read, so it's not like I've got anything inappropriate on either format. But I've been stunned to realize how much I can kind of just, you know, verbally vomit a lot of the time and just talk about stuff that makes absolutely no sense to anybody or like posts for whatever particular reason. So I've taken this daunting task of unliking everything I've ever liked on Facebook. And I thought I was the only person doing this until today. Somebody who I am Facebook friends with, never met, but, you know, we have chatted socially on the network, as they would say, and have enjoyed each other's commentaries and posts and pictures of life and what's going on in the world. I didn't shared or said anything to this person out of Washington State about doing anything like this, and he sent a post earlier today saying, hey, I just got finished unliking everything on Facebook, and of course, you know, he's making some other, you know, directed comment about what was going on in the world, and I just thought that was, boy, what a, is it coincidence, or is there something more to it that people are now kind of, you know, stepping away from this giant monster of social media? Anyway, that is not a topic for tonight, but it is a topic I'd like to talk about with you at a future date and time. So just plant that seed in the back of your head just a tiny little bit. And welcoming to the show right now, Mr. R.J. Tolson. R.J., how are you tonight?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. I'm so excited that you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So the 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon rule applies here. So for everybody who is an R.J. Tolson fan, they're like, well, of course we know who he is. But for everybody who is new to this name tonight, you are going to be in for a real treat in learning about this brilliantly talented young man and all the things that he's doing in life. But I need to give a big shout-out to Tatiana, who was on our show a few weeks ago, talking about her line of fashion and a film that she was part of and all kinds of exciting things that she's doing. She's here in Southern California as well. And after talking with Tatiana, she goes, you must meet my friend RJ because he is fantastic. And I said, well, okay, that's great. And so I wanted to thank you for visiting with me and Nolan a couple of weeks ago out in L.A. having a quick brunch and, finally, you know, twisting your guys' arm to get you on the show. So it's a real treat for me to have you take time out of your night. Thank you.
No, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
So for everybody who is new to the R.J. Tolson name, and you won't be after tonight, can you give the listeners a little bit of history about who you are and, you know, where you grew up and all kinds of that fun stuff before we start talking about your projects and all the things that you're doing today?
Sure, of course. Growing up, let's see, as a kid, I was pretty much, I guess, like every 90s kid, I was had my face plugged into a Game Boy playing video games. So there wasn't too much as I was young, and I was always into fantasy, a lot of stuff with fiction and fantasy. But later in grade school, when I got up into middle school, I started reading a lot, fiction work mainly, and I used to play tennis all the time. And so I had sports. I did karate. I did swimming, like I said, a lot of reading. And then I actually went to boarding school from 7th grade on to the end of high school. And I was able to, because of that, I was able to be in a diverse community with, you know, people from Asia, Europe, all over. And I was able to experience a lot.
And one of the things that I just found fascinating, and of course, you know, when you described it to me and explained it, I was like, well, of course, that totally makes sense. You know several languages. And I said, you know, RJ, how in the world at this stage in the game are you able to be fluent in, what is it, 6 different languages?
Yes.
6. And the answer that you gave me was just, it was kind of like, oh, the light bulb just went off. That totally makes sense. Can you tell me about how you picked up so quickly such a variety of different languages?
Well, originally Spanish was, English, of course. Spanish was kind of the next language I tackled. And that's because I used to have babysitters who spoke a lot of Spanish. Of course, they were from Bolivia. And from there, at the time I couldn't speak it, but I was able to learn how to understand it. At least grasp the concepts, how they spoke. And later on, in middle school, I took Spanish courses, and that kind of helped with that. When I went to boarding school, like I mentioned, I had a lot of Korean, Chinese, and Japanese friends, and so I wanted to be able to communicate on a higher, higher level than I could with English, and I wanted to learn what their language was, their culture. I got very fascinated with it, so I taught myself Korean, and Chinese I began to teach myself, and I actually took summer courses at a boarding school, an intensive Chinese course where I learned Chinese.
So how did that help your relationships with your friends at boarding school? I mean, that had to have set you apart in just a whole variety of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of things. I mean, in middle school, I was very big on Korean, and I actually, the first word I learned was a curse word. And this was back in, 7th grade or 8th grade, and I don't know if this is a good thing or not, but most people at the time at the school didn't know or speak any Korean, really, and that hadn't really been a thing yet, I mean, non-Koreans. And so I was playing basketball in our gym, and this guy kept cursing, and he kept saying this curse in Korean because he kept missing the hoop. You know, the shot. And he just kept saying it over and over and over. And finally I was like, what is he saying? You know, so I went up and I asked him. And then so I kind of caught that from hearing him say it so much because he wasn't the best basketball player, obviously. And he's practicing. And I spread it from there. And my whole school started saying it and getting into Korean words and learning it. So that's kind of my legacy there.
Well, it's an interesting place to start. So from, you know, your time in boarding school and making friends in different cultures, were you, because it sounds like you didn't really have a whole lot of free time. I mean, you were writing, you were involved with, you know, your friends, you were playing sports. Were you also playing music at this point also?
I started playing music, playing music. I've been playing music since I was, 6 or 7. My dad was a musician. He was a trumpet player, and my mother got me into piano when I was very young, and I started playing guitar in middle school. So I was playing instruments, and I played it for fun, but I, you know, later on got more into it when I got into writing music.
So do you have any, out of all the instruments that you learned how to play, do you have a favorite? And do you have one you've learned how to play but you don't like?
Do I have one that I learned how to play that I don't like, you said?
Also, yeah.
Oh, also, okay. I would say the guitar and the piano are my two favorites. I can't choose between the two. And then for one that I've learned to play, I would say, no, I guess I don't really have one that I don't like. They're all
fair
fun.
Enough.
I play the bass, so.
And so when you started to get serious about music, when did that take place?
That was in high school when I was in 10th grade, sophomore in high school, and I got really into classical music, and that might have, I actually don't even know why that happened, but I got into classical music, and I wanted to be able to compose music like John Williams and Nicholas Hooper, a lot of other famous classical composers for movies and stuff. And so I taught myself music theory, and then I actually took the course later on.
When you're playing classical music, you said you don't know how that came about. You mentioned in your book that we're going to talk about in just a little bit, Project Limitless Volume 1, you talked about, you know, setting the right stage and doing some different things, and you said, you know, playing music for you is one of them. Is that maybe when you're doing writing, which is something that you're also passionate about, is that maybe something that you just kind of fell into and then it just kind of became part of your DNA?
Yeah, I definitely, and writing had pretty much been an evolution. When I started reading, it kind of evolved into writing, which happens to most people, most writers. And then for the music, I mean, I've been able to combine it with my writing, and that's probably why I got so into it, so passionate, because with writing, I'm trying to spread emotion and stories, and music can do the same thing.
So how do you manage your time as a high school student involved in so many different capacities creatively? Because one of the things that you talk about in your book is, you know, that, you know, you figure out how to manage your time well. And I'm still in awe, I'll say I'm in shock and awe of you for your ability to do as much with your 24 hours as you do, because I need to take the master's course on that myself. So in high school, how do you find the discipline and the ability to really develop your passions while still just trying to be, you know, a regular kid? And I don't think you really fit into that category, but that would be the question I'd ask for you.
I would say, I mean, back when I was in high school, I mean, things were a lot less busy. And even looking back on it, before my senior year, when I really started getting into the business and writing, really into writing, I had soccer, I had sports, I had a curriculum, but everything was pretty much set out for me in boarding school, and most of the other kids were doing the same thing. And so I guess at that point it wasn't too hard, too stressful, until, like I said, I actually started adding on more stuff, like my book, like trying to write a book during my senior year. And I think time management-wise, I was just able to figure it in to a point where, like, for example, I'm a night person, and so I would stay up I would start writing around 11 and stay up till like about 1 o'clock, and I would write my chapters as a senior in high school, and then I'd get up around 7 o'clock, 7:30 for breakfast and to get ready for school.
And off you went. So when you started writing your chapters at 11 o'clock at night, what did you end up doing with these chapters, and how did you start getting them out there for people to enjoy?
Well, I originally was just writing because I really wanted to write, and I wanted to finish. I'd written multiple stories before then, probably like 100 or so, up until that point, from when I was in seventh grade when I started writing until my senior year. And up until that point, I really hadn't finished a full novel, and I really wanted to, a full story. And so I started with Zephyr, The West Wind, and from there I started actually posting my chapters online because I wanted feedback. And the website I used was Wattpad, and it was like the YouTube for books at the time, and it still is even bigger than it was then now. And I had people read my book, read the chapters and comment on them and get really interested in them, become fans, and that's how I started to get it out there.
So as a seventh grader, what do you sit down and say, you know what, I'm going to write a story today? And at some point, you have to know that, you know, what you're writing is pretty good, or at least, you know, you like what you're writing enough to want to read it. What did you start writing about as in your first few stories, and how did that help you in your development as a writer growing up through high school, getting to the point where you want to publish a book, and even today?
Well, I started before I started writing stories back, this is about fifth, sixth grade, I started to write poetry, and that's because it was the first real writing I got into. I was able to see, and I really liked, because I really hadn't been reading too many books at that point. And then after that, after I wrote a couple of poems myself, and my mom would hang them up in the house and, you know, be all proud of them, and I started writing stories, and those stories were, they were really imitations of other stories. I didn't really have, I had my own imagination, but I wasn't really using it in my writing because I had to mimic other writers to learn how to write properly.
Okay.
And so I started doing that, started coming up with similar concepts, and then actually in seventh grade when I went to boarding school, I started using my friends in my stories and coming up with new story ideas. And I guess probably one of the big motivations, too, for writing at that time was actually that I was including my friends. And so they always would read the stories.
Oh,
I had
okay.
four or five would read it, and most of them were my best friends at the time. And they loved reading them and, you know, reading stories with them in it. And I loved writing them with all of us and having adventures and stuff. And, yeah, so, I mean, that's pretty much how it started and evolved.
That is so brilliantly smart. You know, one of my favorite books that I've ever read, and I try to go back and read it at least once a year, is How to Win Friends and Influence People. And one of the things that I always remember in the book is, you know, everybody likes to, you know, see their name in print or hear their name on the radio or TV or whatever the case may be. So, you know, and you were just doing it because it's fun to include your friends in the stories. So what were the stories based on? Was it like a fantasy story or, you know, like the Lifetime movie, The Week story, or what did you write about?
At the time, I definitely wrote fantasy. I was super into fantasy. All of my friends were super into fantasy. At the time, it was probably stuff similar to Harry Potter. I didn't write about wizards and magic, really. I wrote more about action, so more like medieval time periods where they had swords
cool.
and dealing with stuff like that, rather than, you know, like the wizard stuff that was really big at the time or Hunger Games type stuff.
So as this started to grow and evolve, and you said you started posting your chapters online, how did it evolve into becoming an actual full-fledged book for you?
Well, as I started posting more chapters after the first couple, and I had built up a fan base of probably a couple hundred people who were reading the chapters consistently every day, it just exploded one week. I was writing a big fight scene at the time, and while they were waiting for the chapters, because I posted them every other day, every other day, so like pretty much like times a week, yeah. And I had that fan base, while they were waiting for that chapter to come, go up to 1 million, or 500,000 almost, and then it went to 1 million.
Holy
and
cow.
Went to 1 million. Yeah, over the time, over a couple months, it went over to 8 million by the time I finished the book.
So have you been able to trace back organically what happened? Or, you know, I know they were waiting for a specific thing, but was it like, you know, somebody told two friends and they told two friends and so on and so on? Was it really like as simple as that, or did something bigger happen that you are aware of?
I think what happened really was, well, like I said, I had a couple hundred fans, and then I had people reading the book, hundreds of people reading it a day, you know, a couple hundred. And from there, yeah, they would tell their friends. Word of mouth is always the fastest way to spread. And the Wattpad community at that time, where the website where I was posting them, they're very loyal. And once they get into a story, it's like, you know, they're obsessed with it. And I was lucky enough to get people to be like that. And they spread it around. They posted it, started posting it all over the website. People who weren't on the website started reading it because it would show up, you know, online when people search in good story to read. It would come up using Wattpad. And free books, free stories, and, yeah, it just exploded from there.
So what was – calling it a big break sounds kind of silly, but what was your big break? Because I know that there was some person that read the book that said, okay, we need to talk to this brilliant writer. And how did that come about for you?
Well, what happened was as I was posting these chapters, I had – one of my fans was a publisher, and – when I finished the book and I was trying to sort out, I was going to self-publish it originally. Someone had mentioned me about self-publishing, and I said, okay, well, I'll try and self-publish it, see what I could do. And this is when I was 17. So I had no idea what I was doing about publishing. And as I finished self-publishing the book, my publisher, who is my publisher now, Coop is his name, he came, emailed me and called me later on and said that they want to publish my book, because he was a fan of my book from the very beginning, and he had to get, you know, he had to talk to his chief publisher and get sorted out to get actual contact with me and work something out. And by the time he did, I had self-published it, and they wanted to republish it, redo it and republish it.
So what was your experience like in trying to do the self-publishing? Because there, I know there, one of the great things on this show, and I don't really know, understand the dynamic of it, is we get a ton of authors and a ton of people who have published best-selling books, as well as people who want to be best-selling authors and always somewhere in between. And, you know, we've had a lot of people that have done the self-publishing route and have had, you know, different degrees of success with it, but they certainly have not been 17 years old. I mean, the last author that I had on that did this, he turns 81 the beginning of November. So, you know, and his book was wonderfully written. It was a fantastic story, and I loved reading it. He says, yeah, I just wanted to self-publish it, and, you know, I didn't really think that there would be a fan base for it. But you read it, and you're like, holy cow. And that's the same type of a response that, you know, people got when they were reading your book. And to have, you know, the publisher after the fact come back to you, I think is really cool. But what did you go through yourself in – what was the process like in trying to figure out how to self-publish? What decisions did you have to make? What was really easy for you in that process? What was hard?
When I was 17 and I was self-publishing, I pretty much made the same mistakes that a majority of self-publishing authors do, or self-published authors do, and that's I didn't really meet the standards of the traditional publishing industry. Meaning, for example, I had a cover that was badly photoshopped, and it didn't the editing wasn't professional, and it wasn't formatted correctly, and I didn't know any of this stuff. I had no one to tell me about it at the time. And so I pretty much just took the raw version of the book that I had and had someone edit it a bit, not a professional editor, and I had submitted it, and, you know, I added a cover to it, had someone create that, and I just self-published it. But from there, I mean, the mistake was, I mean, if you look at the original version of Zephyr the West Wind, which is the self-published one, then you can see the huge difference between how when it was republished by a publisher. I mean, the formatting, the editing, the cover itself, the way it's formatted, it's so much better. And that's not to say that a lot of self-published people don't, you know, publish their book professionally and do it very well. But at the same time, a majority of them don't, which is why, as of now at least, why there's a stigma on self-publishing. But I think the – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the biggest mistake most self-publishing authors make, and now that I'm actually into publishing, is that, one, they don't put enough into their book, the exterior part of the book, meaning the cover and the way it's formatted. Even if it's a great story, it's not going to sell without a great cover and a great format.
So two questions here. One is, are there old copies around that we can find on, like, eBay or someplace and gobble them up before, you know, the other copy goes, so it becomes like a collector's item, like the Wizard of Oz. That would be question one. And then number two, you know, you were alluding to the fact that, you know, you might have written the next great American novel, but if your cover is terrible, nobody's going to buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
So how valuable was that marketing lesson to you? Because it sounds like you were really astute along the way, but again, you know, a little bit of trial and error is a good learning experience, I think, for all of us.
Definitely. I try and spread that lesson on to all of my authors, meaning the ones that are published with my publisher as well as ones that I've helped get published and or published myself. And I mean, it's extremely important. A book could be the greatest book, have the greatest story in the world, and no one will pick it up because they don't like the front cover. That's just the way marketing works in most cases. And to answer your
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, to answer your first question, I was sorry, can you repeat the first question? I don't want to.
Well, no, I think we're good there, and I don't want to beat the
okay.
Self-publishing issue. It's really, are there collector's
okay.
items out there? Can we go find them? You know, I guess I shouldn't have said that. I should just go and buy them all right now, and I'll hang on to them in a box or something like that for 5 years. Anyway, okay, so let's get back. So you've written your book. It's been self-published. You are a big soccer star here in Southern California, and it's time to go to college. What happens as you are playing your last game of soccer here in Whittier?
Well, when I came to Southern California for college, I was all into soccer. It wasn't really about the writing yet. And or my business as much, and I was playing for my college. What we call Hell Week, which is where, you know, you have to do rigorous training for 1 week right before school starts, and then you go into the season. And I went through that, I passed that, and I was playing. But at that same time, I actually had played, well, after the first game, I had got my publishing contract sorted out, and I had to quit soccer because of that. I didn't have time for soccer, for school, and for my business and publishing. So I was pretty disappointed at that.
I was going to say, that probably would have just killed you. As somebody who is, you're a very active guy, I'm surprised that you actually get 6 hours of sleep a night or 7 hours of sleep. I'm very impressed to hear that tonight, by the way. So in picking out all of these, okay, let me see, I want to back up. You also had the chance to intern with a great musician, American legend, and spend some time back east. Is that something we can talk about now?
Yeah, sure. After my freshman year in college, it was about 2 years ago, I had an internship. I was looking for internships in Boston because I wanted to actually visit my friend and spend some time over in Boston, and I found some internships that had to do with music because I wanted to expand my knowledge and become a better composer and musician, and I got an internship with the Boston Symphony at that time,
That's just crazy. Yep. I mean, I don't know. I'm just so impressed with you. It's like, yeah, and then I had my internship with the Boston, nobody says that. This is, okay. So how did the experience go for you? What was really valuable to you during that whole time?
It was a brilliant experience. I had a great time, and I learned a lot, of course. But I think one of the greatest things that I did learn was how to compose music that expresses, where you're able to really put your own emotion into music and how to kind of organize that and how to set it up so that the music you can play, because this is classical music, the music that you can play really is what you're trying to give out to your listeners. So if I want someone to feel sad, they feel sad when listening to the music.
I love the fact that you are a composer of classical music. You are fascinating on just so many levels. How does I'm going to call you just a modern day musician. How does a modern day musician, who's not 600 years old, write classical music that is contemporary to a modern audience?
That's a good question. I guess for me personally, the tie-in has been really my writing, and that's kind of what I use to base my music off of. So, for example, if I have a piece, usually when I create music, it's based off of some event or something that's happened in my life. So let's just say, something simple, like I won a soccer game, and it's that would be good. I feel happy, excited, and I would want to express that. And the best way for me to express that is either to write or to compose. And so usually that's how I compose. And I guess just because of this modern day and age, I can relate it to other people's feelings.
Okay. I mean, I love that answer. So I guess everything just kind of starts to get mixed up here. At this point in where you're at in your life journey, have you started your companies yet, or is this still something that is just kind of bubbling in the background with school and everything else that you've got going on?
Have I started my companies now?
The time that you're doing your internship and finishing the first year or two of college and all of that, where were you on the business building plan?
Well, I had started my companies. I actually started those companies at the same time I was writing my book, Zephyr. And they were, at the time, it was small. When I was 17, when I first started, of course, it was just myself. And within a couple months, I got enough work where I needed to hire other people. And so by the time I was turning 19, during the internship, and my company had expanded, I had actually founded a parental company, which is called RGTIO, and this parental company now hosted multiple divisions, which at the time was a charitable division, and then also a web design division, and a web design and computer technology, and a business consulting business.
So putting the charity off to the side for just a second, because I want to spend a nice amount of time talking about that. How did you decide that, you know what, that I'm going to do web design services and business consulting services and all of this at 19? Did you have people coming to you and saying, you know, can you make a website for me? Can you make my website better? How do I improve my social network? What was the impetus for starting something at this age while also all of this other stuff is going on?
At the time when I first came up with the idea to start a company, it was really basic and kind of materialistic. I really wanted to just be able to afford things without having to ask my family for allowance at the time. And so I wanted to be able to have my own money.
I love
and
it.
Not depend on my parents. Yeah, so I came up with an idea which had to allow me to, one, not actually have to spend money, a skill, an idea, and then, two, one that I could use in other people, a service or an idea where that people would need. And at the time, that was web design. I had just finished AP Computer Web Design in high school, the course, and my teacher actually, I had a couple of detention hours for skipping breakfast at the time during we got detention hours, and my professor at the time, she wanted to offer me a chance to get rid of those detention hours. So what I did is I said, okay, how can I do that? And she said, okay, well, here, you do a website for my niece, and I will get rid of your detention hours. So I was like, after I did that, I was like, wow, I could actually make money off this, because pretty much everyone in the future at that time, that was, 4 years ago, people are going to need websites. Everyone and anyone who has a business or does business is going to need a website in the future. And so it's a service that is going to be necessary, and the market's there. And so I said, well, this is the way I can make money and start working. And so I started getting clients. I made my own website, my own business called RGT Inc. at the time, and I started doing web design work, freelance work.
And the rest is history, exactly? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yep.
So one of the things I'm really impressed with you in developing your business model is that you also wanted to find ways to give back to the communities here in the United States, but also around the world. What is your charity's name, and how does it operate? What are you accomplishing with what you do?
So my charity, which is a division of my parental company, RGTIO, it's called Forever Trust Charity, and at the moment it serves two functions. We hold events, meaning we do cancer walks, AIDS walks, we do host food banks, and we also fundraise for causes, meaning we will donate to another charity. We actually have, right now, I think we support an alliance of 58 U.S.-based charities where we donate to them and we fundraise and we'll try and support them in their doings. And we also have, this is very recent, we expanded into holding some programs. And these programs include, for young youth, I think it's 24 and under, we have study abroad programs where we'll send kids in college and high school to a country in need, and they will teach a skill, whether it's basketball or teaching English or whatever they can do. That's what we send them. We fundraise and we get them over there. And we also have a teaching program where this is very, very recent. It's still in development, actually, this teaching program where we send teachers, we pay them, and they will come over to specific countries that need help, and they will teach professors, like graduate degrees with PhDs and such.
Wow. Just so impressive. For the charities that you've selected domestically, the 50-plus that you have, what were the criteria that you were looking at in determining which types of organizations were going to fit with your culture, with your company?
Most charities are this way, quality charities, like Pencils for Promise is one. We're about passion. Everyone who's in this charity has some passion where it's directed towards helping people and helping humanity as a whole. And when I founded this charity, at the time I had always wanted to have my own charity so that I could not just spread, you know, help a person here and there, but really work towards helping humanity as a whole globally if I could in some way. And Forever Trust is kind of that manifestation. And the criteria for the alliance really is to have the same image. That we have people, we have charities that we support that do a range of charitable work, from music-oriented, where they support people by, you know, being able to buy instruments for them or fundraising so they can buy instruments. We have cancer. We support cancer, the fight against cancer, AIDS, pretty much anything that helps humanity in some way, we try and support, and that's what they do too.
Fair enough. Okay, good to know. So let's talk about the three things that I always say we want to move a little product today, but you have two books and a CD that's out, and if you're watching the show or you're hitting the computer link on your computer to listen to the show either now or in the future, there are three links that will appear on your computer screen. Two of them are for books that Jay has written, Zephyr, and then also Project Limitless Volume 1. Those are both on Amazon. By the way, I was really impressed, and I want to understand why you did it, because I think I know why, but I want you to tell the story. Both books are available for Kindle download at 99 cents, and I went, holy moly, I've got to get these downloaded quick. And one of the things that I really try to do is, even if I have a guest scheduled a long time in advance, I usually try to do my homework like the night before, so that way at least I've got a couple of things that are fresh in my head, because otherwise I'll just forget, because I have so much coming in and out of my head that it just kind of does that. So last night after I did the show, I pulled up the Limitless Volume 1 on Kindle and just started reading, and I was reading until probably about 1:30 this morning, and I finally said, I've just got to put this down because I'm going to finish the book and it's going to be sunrise, and not that that would have been a bad thing, but I needed to get some sleep. I could not put the book down. It was so well written. One of the things that I really liked about the instruction in the book is that you're just not only reading, but you make people actually think. And there's a difference between making people think, but you make people think and then you give them a little homework. And it's fun homework, but it's homework nonetheless, and helping them kind of understand the concepts that you're trying to, you know, lead them towards. How did you decide that, you know what, I'm going to write a book that's like this, but also I'm going to structure it in a way that's going to make people do some work along the way? Because I'm very impressed by that, because that would not be something I would expect from even a seasoned author to come out with, and yet here you are doing this so easily.
Well, I guess maybe that's kind of my fiction type writing style going into my nonfiction writing style, which is that you have to keep the audience, so the reader, engaged. And because Project Limitless is trying, I'm actually trying to help other people who read the book achieve their dreams, start achieving their dreams, and start working towards success. They have to be engaged. They have to want it. And sometimes it requires sacrifice, as I mentioned in the book, and it requires you to really think about things. And luckily enough, I was able to, when I was like 17 and 18, I really was taking a look at my life and what I wanted to do. And I just find that most people, you know, when you read a book, when you read a nonfiction book, it might be interesting and you might find it, you know, intriguing, and you might even read the whole thing, hopefully. And you might stick in your mind for a while, but you might forget it eventually if you never use it. And I find that by being able to connect it to the actual person, because it's not, the book isn't about me, it's about helping the person who's reading it, which means that they have to engage in it. And that's what I try to do with Project Limitless.
Well, and I'm going to tell you, I was in bed with my Kindle, and the puppies were, you know, in bed, snuggled up, and I was like, I'm not going to get up and get a piece of paper and pen at this hour of the night to sit here and write this down. But I've got it on my checklist of things that I'm going to be doing this weekend, so I appreciate the homework that's in the book itself. But it's an easy read, but it really quickly and easily makes you start thinking about what you're doing with your own life. And I think that, you know, selfishly, I think the book came to me at a time where I needed to read it. So I don't know how come I've not seen it before, and I don't know why I didn't read it after our lunch, but I was reading it last night going, I needed all of these messages right now. So for me, it spoke very clearly. But for Zephyr, now you shared with me like a first edition, first copy. You didn't give it to me because I wasn't going to ask, but I was like, oh my gosh, this is a piece of history. You showed me a copy of the very first printing of Zephyr. For listeners who are listening online tonight or again in the future on a upcoming podcast, what is Zephyr about and what inspired you to write it? Can you tell us a little bit about the storyline and what you enjoyed about it?
Sure. So Zephyr is a YA, meaning young adult novel. It's fantasy. And Zephyr is the first book in a 5-book series, and each the first four books each have a new main character, meaning they have a new background, new story. You don't start with the same story until you get to the fifth book where they all connect. Zephyr, like I said, the first book, is about a kid named Zephyr who's 17 years old, and he grew up on an island where everybody hated him. They all ignored him. They treated him like a demon for no reason, and or at least a reason he didn't know. And at the time, he really just wanted to prove to them that he was worth paying attention to. He was worth something. And he goes throughout the story trying to prove that point. He discovers the rest of the world because he's never left the island, and he has a lot of adventures and finds that there's a bigger picture out there. He has a bigger destiny than he ever thought.
So when is the second novel coming out?
The second novel, which is called Heed the Southern Flame, comes out probably in 2 or 3 months.
Hasn't been officially announced. Okay, unofficially announced. We didn't hear it, but okay. That's very cool. Are you going to be doing a similar price point? How did you decide 99 cents? Because I am in awe of that, because I know that you two just came out with a brand new album this week or last week, and they're giving it away free on iTunes right now. And when I found that out last night also, I was like, what is this new concept of giving away your talent for free? I mean, 99 cents, I mean, that instead of, you know, $15.99 or something like that, it's a great deal.
Well, I wanted to, with PLS being 99 cents, I actually originally wasn't, and my publisher had made Zephyr 99 cents because we wanted to promote the book and have people read it and be able to actually access it without having to sacrifice and pay, you know, like $15. And a lot of younger people don't always have the money to read, to really spend on that, and especially because one of the messages within Zephyr is to be able to achieve your dreams no matter what your situation is. And a lot of kids who I've spoken to throughout my travels as an author don't always have the money to afford the book, and a lot of them have computers. Most people have computers nowadays, and so it's an easy way to access the book and hopefully influence them to achieve. And PLS was the same kind of thing, the deal. I asked my publisher to, while Zephyr, because it's for a limited time, only that it'll be 99 cents for now, I wanted PLS to be offered for the same reason. I wanted people to be able to buy the book and really get into it.
Great idea. And I think it's very smartly from a marketing standpoint, you're also building lifelong readers. You know, they'll buy anything that you buy from now until eternity. So you've also got this great CD out. And I think is it on pre-order or has it come out yet?
It's been released. It was released in July.
Okay, let's see. I'm behind the times here. Okay, that one I haven't pressed iTunes. I'm so lax. I'm going to hit the button on the break on the show tonight, right before the show ends. So that's called Chaos Chronicles Zephyr, The West Wind. And this music is part of the Zephyr experience?
Yeah, in a good way, that's a good way of putting it. It's called the original book soundtrack, and it is the first in a trademark of mine, one of my trademark ideas. Kind of like it's pretty much an invention, and it's like a film score, but for the book. And each piece, there's 20 pieces in the soundtrack, and each piece is based off of either a character or an event in Zephyr the West Wind. And classical, mainly classical, yep.
And so any talks about turning this into like a motion picture? I mean, because as soon as you said the five-book series, I went, oh my gosh, you know, Hollywood, big lights, and all of the good stuff that goes along with it.
Well, I hope so. We are trying to work on it right now.
Okay. Well, knock on wood. I'm knocking on my head right now. Okay, so we could turn it into a big motion picture. Get your music into that as well. Very, very cool. Let's see here. As we're getting ready to wrap up the show here, what else do listeners need to know about who you are as a person? What's important to know?
Who I am as a person, I am... I'm 21 years old now, and I'm currently busy with college, finishing up my senior year in college, and I'm working on the second book in the Chaos Chronicles, which will be released soon. And even right now, I'm working on another project, which is a continuation of the Zephyr experience, as you put it, and it's kind of like an art book where it's going to have fan drawings of events and characters in the book, as well as a short story, kind of a comic version of a short story from one of the characters, based on one of the characters. And otherwise, I mean, And I love my dog, personally.
Okay, so tell everybody what kind of dog you have.
He's a Yorkie Terrier, and he is a year and a half, and his name is Cloud.
Cloud is one lucky dog. Hey. So, okay. Where can people find you on social media? Where do you want them to look for you? And where? How else can we support you as a leader in this community?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, pretty much any social network, any social media. And the best way to support is to either grab a copy of Zephyr or PLS and hopefully comment and let me know what you think, or to just support by going on social media and following what my work or any support or any charity events that we host or do.
Awesome. Well, everybody, this has been R.J. Tolson, and just a huge honor for him to take an hour out of his time tonight to visit with us here on Rated G Radio. If you have liked this episode and have enjoyed listening to R.J. tell his story, please share this with your friends. He's somebody who is a great leader and a great person in our community, and I think it's somebody that we really need to take a look at and be inspired by. I am, and I can't thank you enough for being here. RJ, hang on
thank
the line.
You, yeah.
We're going to play a song called Something Real. I think it's fitting for RJ tonight. And this is by Joseph Eid, a recent guest on the Friday Night Dance Party. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You say I don't communicate, but I only like to speak from my soul. You say things with your words, but you never say them with your eyes. And I guess that's how this story goes. You're like a robot, 1, 2, 3. You read books on how you should feel. Got a gifted mind, but it ain't connected to your heart. And I wonder sometimes if you're real. But maybe it's your generation and your sexist conversation, and you love me so. My sweet time, I don't spill it all out like cheap wine. You got to earn this love degree. Yeah, you do. And baby, it's like alienation when your sex are conversations, and you love me so.
Problem with emotion. I just don't like to rub it all over like lotion.
You say I don't communicate, but I think there's a time, there's a place. You sent me a real cute YouTube and you put it all up on Twitter too, but baby this bird needs some space. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And maybe it's your chance. get close so you feel it. My words may be far between, baby, I know that we're digital, but darling, we're still human after all. And I like to use a phone sometimes to make a voice call, and I don't want to spend my deepest moments alone. The screen just hidden then, you know I like.
That was Little Joseph Eid, Something Real. You need to check out his music video for that on YouTube. It is really cute. And Joseph Eid, E-I-D, that's how you spell his last name. And his video is Something Real off of his album Human. And if you get a chance to go see him play live in a Technicolor, I'm going to encourage you to do that. If you happen to be in North Hollywood tonight, you've got about 10 minutes left until the Federal Bar is headlining Suzanne Wong and her comedic talent. She's the headliner there tonight, and she's also got her friend Matt Eisman as a featured act, and he's also extremely funny. So if you have a chance to go, I think the cover is $10, and it's the Federal Bar, 5303 Lancashire Boulevard, North Hollywood, California, 91601. And Suzanne Wong, you'll remember her from TV's House Hunter. She's also a guest host on the show about a month or so ago. Brilliantly funny, and just really an honor to know her and call her a friend. This coming Saturday, if you are in Orange County, we have the Orange County Screenwriters Association Luncheon, and it's going to be the Claim Jumper in Fountain Valley, California. Julie Selbo, who has been featured on Touched by an Angel and Undressed, and was involved with the Young Indiana Jones and Models, Inc., and Hercules and the Amazing and the Amazon Women, and so on, and so many other things. She's going to be the featured speaker this coming Saturday. It's 9:30 to 1:30. You get a nice little lunch. You get a little networking with people who are involved in writing or producing or acting or hangers-on. I'm a hanger-on, so I'm going to go there and hang on with the people there, the OC Screenwriters Brunch, because on the side I'm working on a sitcom, and one of the directors that would like to film the pilot for it will be there, and I'm hoping that also one of the writers that I'm working with will also be in attendance, so that will be kind of fun. So if you have a chance to go see the Orange County Screenwriters Association Luncheon with special guest Julie Selbo, I encourage you to go do that this Saturday, 9:30 to 1:30 at Claim Jumper in Fountain Valley, and I believe there's like a $20 charge which covers, like, you know, eating your lunch. So join me this Saturday. It will be fun, and I will be there. In the world of Facebook, while the song was playing, I got pinged by several people, and they were all saying, we listened to the interview, and we now realize RJ's accomplished more at his age than we ever have. And So anyway, several people have made that comment, including Bill in upstate New York. So, Bill, I'm with you, my brother. But when I hear RJ speak, what it does for me automatically is says that at any age you can be brilliant. So, number one, RJ has been brilliant coming out of the womb. But, he's been brilliant and smart and creative at a very early age, and I think that allows us at any age to say, you know what, I want to be brilliant and creative and smart as well. So if you aren't, you now have the official license to be those three things. Hey, quick reminder, tomorrow night we've got Dennis Hensley. I'm going to call him the Hollywood man about town, and I mean that in a complimentary sense, but he's been a writer on Fashion Police. He has he hosts the Mismatch Game up in West Hollywood. He is a star of Let's Take a Holiday. It's a short film that's a comedy musical with this we'll find out about that tomorrow as well, and so much more. I've heard Dennis on the Frank DeCaro show on Sirius XM, and am always going, oh, that Dennis Hensley, he sounds like a nice guy. And one of the Rated G Radio listeners, Paulin Mass, and also a Sirius OutQ listener, Paulin Mass, says, why don't you have Dennis on the show? You know, he'd be a great guest. So I said, oh, yeah, I guess that would be great. So I reached out to Dennis about a week or two ago, and he says, sure, I'd love to come on. So we're going to have Dennis come on tomorrow night. He's going to stay for the entire hour, and we're going to just talk about all things having to do with Hollywood and his experience. He is a riot. He's also a serious podcaster as well. So hopefully I will learn a thing or seven from Mr. Hensley tomorrow. He regularly gets upwards of the 7, 8, 9, and 10,000 listen mark. And for a podcast, that's an impressive number because, again, podcasts are not regular terrestrial radio or Sirius XM where you're just, you know, clicking around trying to find something that you might like to listen to. Podcasts you actually have to want to listen to, just like Rated G Radio. So anytime you have people on your show that spike ratings and do things like that, that's always a fun thing. So Dennis Hensley will be my special guest Thursday, and then Friday, don't forget, a early Friday night dance party starting bright and early at 6 p.m. with Fontaine's Muse, and we're going to be playing 2 hours of their music, taking you behind the scenes, behind all of the brilliant work that this husband and wife musical duo create. Flash is the husband, and he plays the Indian sitar brilliantly, and Fontaine is the, I guess, the muse, and she sings, and she's got a voice that just sounds like angels from the heavens above. You will love their music, and I will tell you, I'm not a big fan of Indian music, and hearing all of their music on a couple of Saturdays ago when I was at an event that they were at, I bought all 4 of their CDs that they had left because they were selling that quickly, and I've been playing them nonstop. So really excited to have this brilliant pair on the show this coming Friday. In the coming weeks, we have Dr. Shannon Connor coming up on Monday the 15th. She's going to talk about child health care and what's wrong with the world today. We've also got David Cohen out of New York coming on to talk about black coin, kind of like Bitcoin, except, you know, without the scandal. He'll be on next Wednesday. And musician Eric Kamen will be on at a special 5 p.m. start time on Friday, the 19th. And so much more. I mean, we've just got tons of great guests lined up for the rest of the month of September. I'm always thrilled and delighted that you are here to be part of this experience with me every night. And if you like it, come back. Tell your friends, you know, and just like RJ's, you know, RJ's blog and, you know, writing the chapters, tell 2 friends. And with that, we are going to end the night with, let's pick something kind of fun. How about a little Deborah Cox tonight? Absolutely not. We'll see you live tomorrow night with Dennis Hensley. Tune back in.
Listening to Rated G Radio.